You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Which way is the front line from here? A documentary about photojournalist Tim Hetherington premieres 2 years after the day of Hetherington's death. When the film opens, we see him and his colleagues in a car at a checkpoint on a dusty road in Misrata, Libya, en route to capturing the kinds of images he'd become famous for, photos and videos that reveal the human cost of conflict. Here to talk about the film are two of Mr. Hetherington's fellow journalists, collaborators, and friends, Sebastian Younger, who directed the documentary, and James Brabazon, who produced it. It will air on HBO tomorrow at 8 p.m., and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Younger back to our show, along with Mr. Brabazon. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sebastian, you said that you began work on this documentary soon after Tim Hetherington's death. You were able to interview friends and colleagues who'd come to New York for the memorial service.
Yes, there were a number of journalists who had survived the attack that Tim was killed in, and Chris Hondros as well was killed in. And they were here for the memorial. I thought, this is the only chance I'll have them all in one place. I want to interview them, at least to satisfy my own questions about what happened that day, April 20, 2011. And then after, they were very moving interviews, very upsetting interviews. Around that time, we also were able to look at some of the footage that Tim shot on his video camera on his last day alive in a lot of combat. And that others had shot, and I thought, well, we have the basis for a really powerful film. I went straight to HBO with Nick Quested of Goldcrest Films, a good friend and a friend of Tim's, and very, very quickly, I mean, like in half an hour, Sheila Nevins at HBO okayed the project.
James, how old was Tim when he died?
He was 40 when he died.
And how was he killed?
He was killed by shrapnel from a mortar bomb, which fell in the city of Misrata. It injured several people, killed Tim and Chris Hondros. He was actually killed by, in fact, a very small piece of shrapnel which severed his femoral artery.
Chris Hondros was also a photographer, Getty photographer. Mm. Is there a fraternity of combat photojournalists? I would have thought that, based on old movies, that they were rather competitive.
yeah, there is a fraternity. There's actually, in terms of both combat video and photography, there's a very, actually, strangely, very small number of people who are really sort of deeply engaged in that profession. And most of us know each other or know of each other.
And you know the dangers that you all face.
You know the dangers that you face, but I can really stress that Tim was not a war photographer in the classic sense of the description. He was much more, he was a photographer who often went to war. And as such, it was very unusual for Tim to be working with other people in that fraternity like that. Although he knew them and often, you know, we'd come across people in conflict, he usually worked much more separately and individually.
Because he wasn't going to the front lines in the ways that others were, although he was always near the fighting.
Well, he would go to the front line and would be deeply immersed in the fighting, but quite often the projects that he worked on, for example, in Afghanistan with Sebastian or in Liberia with me, in both of those scenarios, there were no other journalists there at all. And that's what interested him, was telling untold stories, not simply hanging around with the press pack who are, you know, filing wire stories.
Sebastian, he described himself as being emotionally embedded with his subjects. Didn't he even use a type of camera that allowed him to appear less threatening to his subjects than he would have looked if he was using a more commonly used 35-millimeter SLR camera?
Yeah, he shot film, and he had a Rolleiflex and a Hasselblad.
So there's 120 film instead of 35-millimeter.
I guess it's 120, yeah.
Yeah, roll film.
And he would look down into the viewfinder instead of having the camera in front of his face. And so that way he could compose the photo glancing downwards and then engage the person in a conversation eye to eye, which he felt was very important because, as he said, he's a tall, big, tall, white guy in a foreign country, and he sort of towered over a lot of people, and he wanted to be able to engage them so that they would relax.
Is that a style that others have used? Do you talk to your subjects?
Well, it's a very good way of engaging with the subjects because it allows you to look at them directly in the face. You don't have something literally obscuring your face while you're working. For your audience members who don't really understand the logistical implications of this, shooting combat on a Rolleiflex is an exceptionally difficult undertaking. You know, you're looking down into a mirror, which is it's really used for composing studio pictures. I'm sitting in a car with Tim on the assault on Monrovia, the capital of Liberia, being ambushed at close quarters, while he was taking shots on his Rolly on a strip of film that allows you to take a maximum of 12 photographs at a time, and then changing paper-backed roll film, handing it back to me in the car, changing the roll, shooting more pictures. It's fundamentally, it's a 1930s way of working. But what it does is it slows you down, and it means that every frame you shoot has to count. And I personally find a lot of the still photographs that he took, they because there is that stillness about them, because you have to slow down to take them, you seem to, by extension, develop an additional layer of understanding in the image itself.
So he wasn't doing the usual ka-chung, 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 and then going through 3,000 negatives and saying, okay, here are two that really work well.
No, not at
now,
all.
Now, he called himself an image maker, not a photographer. Did you talk about that with him, Sebastian?
Yeah, I mean, photography didn't interest him per se. His camera allowed him to do what he really wanted to do, which was to engage with people and really understand their lives and to tell their stories. So he didn't want to just take great photos, and he did because he was incredibly disciplined. He understood the technical aspects really, really well. What he wanted to do was understand people's stories, and he felt that any form, any media was fair game to tell stories. You know, audio, videotape. I mean, I practically think he would have used crayons to tell stories if it had allowed him to tell the story more effectively.
My guests are Sebastian Younger and James Brabazon. We're talking about a documentary called Which Way is the Front Line from Here, which will be premiering tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on HBO. James, you not only produced this documentary, but you shot some of it and you even appear in it. You tell a funny story of how you first came to work with Tim. How did you meet?
Well, we met because I've been working in Liberia for a year, in working with the Lerd rebels who were fighting to overthrow Charles Taylor, and I had a sort of exclusive access to them. It was just sort of me working with them, and
you said you were very comfortable working alone.
Yeah, I was very comfortable working alone. I had, you know, I had my scoop, I had my access, I had my story. I was good to go, and Tim, who I didn't know, called me up out of the blue, and said, "Oh, I'd really love to come with you." And come and work with you. And so I agreed to meet him for a cup of coffee, more out of curiosity than anything else. And I thought, there's absolutely no way that this is going to happen. Why would I want to take someone else into, you know, my exclusive story? And I sat down and spoke to him, and it was like having a little spell cast over you. And I just sat down, and we just instantly hit it off. It's like, okay, this is someone that I can work with. And within a month, we were on the front line outside of Monrovia together, and I think that was probably the best professional decision I ever made.
And out of that came a film called Liberia, An Uncivil War, got you an Emmy nomination.
That's right, yeah. You know, what we did in Liberia together then, it rapidly became clear to me that on a professional level, it's not something that I could have achieved by myself. I needed to have someone there with me. And on a personal level, you know, I mean, I think this is something else that comes out in Which Way's the Front Line from Here, is that the being in war is like a pressure cooker for the emotions. And Tim and I rapidly became very close personal friends as a result.
Sebastian, you also collaborated with Tim. Is that important that you have somebody to blow off steam to?
Well,
under the kind of pressure that you're working?
It helped immensely to have Tim out there at Restrepo. But we weren't always together. Most of our trips were actually apart because we were trying to cover a lot of territory. And so we would switch off. Trips. But when we were together, sometimes it was very tense, a bad situation, and it helped enormously to be able to talk to someone who was more my age, who wasn't a soldier. We were very close to the soldiers, but it really helped, particularly talking about the emotions involved. You know, soldiers aren't really allowed to have emotions. It's counter to their survival. And Tim and I weren't under those strictures, and we really struggled sometimes, and it just helped tremendously to be able to talk to him.
James, one of the most moving sections in this documentary focuses on the time that Tim spent in Sierra Leone photographing ordinary people who'd been blinded by rebel soldiers there. Had you seen the images Tim had made at the School for the Blind before you began working on the film?
Yeah, I had actually. By random coincidence, although I'd not met Tim before, when I was working in Sierra Leone myself, I'd been to the Milton Margai School for the Blind, and I'd photographed some of the students there myself, and I talked to the people who ran the school, and they really urged me to have a look at the photographs that Tim had made. So when I got back, I had a look at his work. He was represented by network photographers then, and I could see his work online. I looked at it, and I felt a sort of profound sense of his work was so good and so different, and I felt at that moment that whatever it was that I'd managed to achieve by photographing there, I was never going to achieve that. So when that's partly why when he called me subsequently, I was very intrigued to meet him. But yeah, the work he did in the blind school in Sierra Leone was really the beginning of his journey in conflict.
Well, also, it's the development of his method, which is to connect to his subjects. Anybody who's taking pictures of a stranger tries to make a little contact, but he seemed to actually be able to make everyone into his friend.
He certainly did, and I would watch him do that even when he wasn't working. I mean, I would sort of think sometimes, okay, he's got his camera, he's trying to sort of charm people to get better photos. But then there was, we'd be in a taxi in New York City, and he'd be doing the same thing to the taxi driver, and I realized, what he was really trying to do was understand the human experience.
You visited this show a couple of months after Tim's death to talk about his work and about the dangers inherent in this type of photojournalism. Has Tim's death made you rethink that kind of job in any way?
Me, yes, it has. I within about an hour of learning about Tim's death, I decided to stop war reporting completely. And I was worried, frankly, that war reporting is so compelling and intense and meaningful that I would miss it and that I would sort of, like quitting smoking or whatever, that I'd sort of go back. And I haven't had any desire to do it.
And he had misgivings. He kind of quit going into battle, and then he went off to Libya. It's clear that he thought about the risk that he was taking. You've included footage of him trying to explain to a British TV crew what attracted him to covering conflict.
Conflict is like a vortex. It drags you in. And I think that, Tim was no less immune to that than anyone else who works in conflict. And I think that although, he wanted his work to develop and to progress, what had happened subsequently in the Arab Spring, in Libya, and then in the rest of the Middle East, I think that was very compelling subject material for Tim.
Despite the fact that he was planning to get married and settle down.
I think that Tim certainly wanted to settle down. There was a part of him that terribly wanted to do that. Whether he would have been able to resist that gravitational pull of conflict, I don't know. I got back from 3 weeks filming in Syria very recently, and I remember I was thought very clearly to myself, Tim would have loved this.
So,
that's a strange thing to say about being in conflict, but he would have loved it.
I mean, so his death,
and that's the point that Sebastian was making.
His death and the death of a number of other journalists in Syria and elsewhere hasn't made you think about changing what you do in any way?
No, it hasn't. It's my job. It's what I do, and part of me feels almost that I kind of have a responsibility to keep doing it because I can do it. But Tim's death has made me certainly more cautious in certain respects.
You wear your body armor more.
I do, yeah. I do. I actually, yeah. I mean, I have body armor. Sometimes I wear it, sometimes I don't. It depends on a number of factors. Subsequent to Tim being killed, I very rarely take my vest off, I have to say.
Well, I've spoken with a number of people like Chris Hedges, and then Tim has been on the show, and you, Sebastian. And the word adrenaline often comes up in these discussions. Is that part of it? Is there a kind of an adrenaline addiction to this kind of work?
You know, it's a number of things for journalists. I think soldiers are similar, but it's different. For journalists, first of all, at the sort of more noble end, you feel like you're doing something very important and meaningful in documenting and bringing to light the tragedies of the world. And if they happen in darkness and a media blackout, they'll keep happening. So you feel like you have an important role, and that role is intoxicating. There's a lot of adrenaline in combat. I mean, let's just say it. It's the most intense thing you'll ever go through. And then finally, you know, all the journalists I know, Tim included, myself included, we're all ambitious people. And war, among other things, is a very good place to make your name, to make a reputation, and to advance in your career. So, you know,
same for soldiers.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's sort of, it's all those things.
Well, you, unlike James, sought Tim out. What did you think that he would add to what you could do?
Well,
I mean, you were already famous at that time because you had written The Perfect Storm.
Well, I was on this project with Vanity Fair of documenting a platoon for a year. And I also, sort of unbeknownst to them, I wanted to write a book and make a film. So I started shooting video. I had another photographer with me who wasn't a good partnership. So for my second trip in, I needed another photographer. And Vanity Fair gave me a list of possible names. Tim was on it. I talked to him. I liked him. We took him on. And then when I brought Tim out there, he was sort of amazed by the story. We decided to collaborate on the film, and we also really liked each other, and so he went back the next month to start shooting video himself.
The film was that came out as Restrepo, which was Academy Award nominated documentary and won the 2010 Grand Jury Prize at Sundance, brought the two of you here in 2010. There's also a series of still photographs of sleeping soldiers that Tim shot. They're now on exhibit at the International Center for Photography.
They're extraordinary photos. I mean, people think of war photos as guys with guns, and it's very dramatic. But we forget that these guys are 18, 19 years old, and what Tim saw when they were asleep one very boring hot day at Restrepo was they curled up on the ground or in their bunks. They looked like they were about 10 years old. And so he saw the vulnerability in these young men that is part of being a soldier, is part of war, and that's what he captured.
Now, in the past, still photographers and video or film photographers were separated, usually, although there was often crossover. Strand made movies and others. But is it all pretty much the same thing, James?
I don't think it's the same thing. I think just the industry has changed significantly in the last 10 years, and particularly in the last 5 years, just in terms of the means of distribution has changed so dramatically because of the possibility of publishing and broadcasting on the web. That's changed the industry almost out of recognition. And also as well, it's a small point, but it has huge implications. The actual technology itself, the cameras are much better quality, much cheaper, and tiny. So you can actually shoot video and still alongside each other, whereas previously... Often in the same camera, whereas previously it was logistically, if not professionally, very, very difficult to do that.
You were able to include a great deal of footage here of Tim taken throughout his life. Mm. Were you surprised by how much film had been shot of him?
Well, it was one of the surprisingly sort of great things about Restrepo is that there was just a lot of material of Tim talking. So actually that whole experience of, you know, making the film with Sebastian and then going to the Oscars generated this wealth of material for us. But we also are able to track down a lot of material from other sources at different times of his life as well.
Well, Sebastian, aren't photographers usually more comfortable behind the camera than in front of it?
Well, Tim was a very verbal guy, and he actually relished the role of talking about his work and about the world. There was a funny moment at Restrepo, though. You know, obviously, we were both carried video cameras, and I told Tim, you know, I kept shooting video of him, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Listen, you never know when you're going to need it. Now I've got video of you in combat. You should shoot me. You never know when you're going to need it." And very sadly, that video became kind of precious later when we started making the film.
Now, I've spoken to a number of photographers over the years, and one of the things that always strikes me is they're using pretty much the same camera. They're going to the same place, and yet you can definitely see distinct styles in all of them. You can often identify a photograph as being by a certain photographer just by the way it looks. Mm. How does that happen, James? I mean, and because Tim Hetherington's photographs are very much Tim Hetherington photographs. Mm. Yours are very much yours. Aren't you just framing the same shot?
I think one of the beautiful things about working in visual media is that there are some things which just simply cannot be measured. And the distinction of individual style is something which is almost metaphysical. It's mystical. And I don't think I could really say what it was that generated a unique and individual style for Tim. He got very close. He often worked without a zoom. He'd get very close to his subjects. And, you know, if you look at Tim's, in inverted commas, war photographs, as opposed to other photographers, quite often what you do not see in Tim's work is the machinery of war. Mm-hmm. In Infidel, the book Infidel, for example, there's scarcely a photograph of a rifle in the book. What you see are photographs of people. And I think that his interest in people at war rather than the mechanics of war is something which really helps inform his style.
Did that affect the way you made Restrepo?
I learned a lot from Tim. I was just learning to shoot video. Shooting sort of adequate video in combat is really easy. It's really easy. Shooting good video in combat is not easy, and you have to learn it. And so I learned a lot from Tim, and I can always tell the footage that's his and mine in the film. In Restrepo, it's roughly sort of 50-50, but I can always tell his because he didn't use autofocus. So his shots start with an extreme close-up, and then he sort of grabs the focus, and then he pulls back. And it's actually a wonderful style. I mean, he's solving a technical problem very adeptly, but it actually ends up being a wonderful style and made for great scenes. I never would have thought to do that. I mean, in my footage, you can tell where, you know, in all of my sort of B-roll, you can tell at the point where Tim explained to me what a cutaway was. So then all of a sudden I'm doing cutaways all the time. You can see me, you know, the lessons from Tim in my footage. No, it was such a pleasure working with his material.
Well, now you are a contributing editor with Vanity Fair, you have a number of books under your belt. Are you going to be making films more, or are you back to writing?
Well, here's the thing that I realized. For the kind of writing that I do, there's no conflict, no contradiction with making a film. I mean, if you're in a dynamic situation, rolling videotape makes sense. Taking notes doesn't. No one takes notes in combat, and at least not notes that they can read later. And so what I feel is that the two media really complement each other. And what I'd like to do, and what I'm doing currently right now, actually, is writing books and making documentaries on the same topic to come out in tandem.
And James, you have worked in 70 countries so far, mostly like really dangerous ones. Is this just a way of seeing the world?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Well, it's done very well for you. You've won the Rory Peck International Impact Award 2003, the IDA Courage Under Fire Award in 2004. And now you produce this film. Does that mean that Sebastian did all the real serious work on it?
What it means is that I get to go to all the parties. And now the role of being a producer on a film like this is that if the film is a success, then the director says, and I'm the director, and if it stinks, everyone says, then this is the producer. No, in seriousness, obviously Sebastian bore the vast brunt of the work on this. But although he says he's not going back to conflict and he's done with it, it's now becoming a little bit of a mission of mine to convince him otherwise.
Meanwhile, people can see. You want to say something, Sebastian?
I was going to say, next he'll get me smoking.
Tim Hetherington's Sleeping Soldiers will be on view through May 13th at the International Center of Photography at 1133 Avenue of the Americas. It's at 43rd Street. The film, Which Way Is the Front Line From Here? The Life and Time of Tim Hetherington will be shown first on HBO tomorrow at 8 p.m., and then there'll be other screenings. By the way, there's also a new book about Tim Hetherington by Alan Huffman called Here I Am. It's published by Grove Atlantic. You might want to find out more about the story from that perspective. And my great thanks to both of you, Sebastian Junger and also James Rabizan, for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.